This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Coming up later this hour, a conversation with the outgoing director of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Francis Collins, and the story of how Filipino-American nurses became a crucial part of the U.S. healthcare system. But first, COVID boosters are now approved for millions more people with your choice of which one to get. Yesterday, a CDC advisory panel recommended booster doses for those who've received the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, and those recommendations were approved last night by Director Rochelle Walensky. That means both Moderna and Pfizer recipients who are 65 and older and those with certain medical conditions can get booster shots starting today. And for those who got the J&J vaccine, a booster shot is now recommended for all recipients of that vaccine at least 2 months after the first shots. As for mix and match vaccine boosters, the CDC now says eligible individuals may choose which vaccine they receive as a booster dose. There's some evidence that both Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines provide a better boost than the J&J shot. We'll keep following this story as it unfolds. In other big science news this week, for the first time, doctors attached a pig kidney to a human patient for 54 hours, and it worked, functioning like a human kidney. The donor pig had been genetically modified, and the human subject was brain dead and maintained on a ventilator. It's a step that could open up new possibilities for those who need transplants.
The single biggest problem that we have right now in transplantation is that we just don't have enough organs available. About half of the people who are waiting die before they get a transplant.
Dr. Robert Montgomery was the lead surgeon on the team at NYU's Langone Transplant Institute.
It tells us that a pig kidney can function normally in a human for several days. It tells us that a pig kidney can be transplanted into human without an immediate rejection.
That audio, courtesy of NYU. Montgomery says they want to gather more input from medical ethicists and the legal community, but he hopes to move to living human trials within a year or two. And now on to more news about climate change. To address it with me is Kendra Pierre-Lewis, a senior reporter for the Gimlet Spotify podcast, How to Save a Planet. Welcome back, Kendra.
Thanks so much for having me, Ira.
Nice to have you. Let's start with President Biden's big plans for climate change action in the U.S. The infrastructure bill, the Build Back Better Plan's clean energy program, have been moving through Congress this summer and fall. And as they say, where are they now?
So the word on the street, or I guess the word in the halls of D.C. is basically that they don't have enough votes because Manchin refuses to sign it. He's opposed to it. Ostensibly, he's opposed to it because his state, West Virginia, is a heavily coal-producing state. But the reality is that he also has financial interests in coal. And so people are thinking that it's more tied to his financial conflict of interest than it is to the best interests of his state, which is not immune to climate change. You know, the state has, because of climate change, seen both more intense drought, like a severe drought in 2015 that affected every single county in the state, and increased rainfall. You know, flood. There was a 1,000-year flood in 2016, and there's more routine flooding. And with that flooding, because West Virginia is a mountain state, there have been landslides, you know?
Yeah. Well, is meaningful reduction of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions possible without the measures in these bills?
So there's one analysis by the Rhodium Group, which says that we can do it through a variety of measures, but that report is incredibly optimistic, saying that we're going to depend heavily on carbon capture technologies on a scale that we've never seen before. So absent that one report, broadly speaking, it's not possible if we want to be in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. It's not possible if we want to stave off the worst effects of climate change. We're hitting all of the timetables. It's a physics and a time problem, and we're not acting quickly enough. And every day of delay makes it harder. Every day of delay, A, releases more emissions, and B, makes it harder to reach the targets that we need to have in order to avoid the most catastrophic effects of climate change.
I want to go back to West Virginia for a second, because as you mentioned, Joe Manchin's mm-hmm. vote is so crucial in passing this legislation. But as you alluded to, his constituents in West Virginia are themselves at risk from climate change. I mean, it's sort of ironic here, is it not?
Yeah, and there have been actually a lot of protests by his constituents. There was a boat protest. There have been several trying to get him to sign on. His constituents are aware both of the harms that they're facing from climate change and the benefits that this package has in creating clean energy jobs in their community.
Yeah. Is there any potential benefit to the coal industry if we don't push? No.
Coal, sorry, that was like such a fast no. Coal in general is on the decline. It's more concerned about the natural gas industry, which is really heavily trying to prop up itself in that region. But practically speaking, there's no long-term benefit to coal. It's on the decline. It's just making it limp out more slowly so that it can do the maximum amount of damage on its way out.
Mm-hmm. And all of this on the brink of a major international conference on meeting the Paris Agreement goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. This is not a good look for the U.S., is it?
It's not a good look for the U.S., and it's not a good look especially because the commitments that we know that basically in 2015, every country made commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius and ideally below 1.5 degrees Celsius, right? Like the hard target is 2C and the soft target was 1.5C. The 1.5 degrees C report came out in 2018, and we know now that 1.5 degrees C of warming is more catastrophic than we thought. And that 1.5 degrees C in part got into the Paris Agreement because low-lying island states were very concerned about their ability to continue to exist. And we now know that as it gets above 1.5 degrees C, many of these countries will cease to exist. So it's not a good look for us. And it's especially not a good look for, it's not a good future for those countries.
So we're showing up to COP26 without having done our own homework.
Mm-hmm. And at COP26, we're supposed to be ramping up our commitments. So the commitments that we made in 2015, we're supposed to go back and we're supposed to revise them and we're supposed to be even stricter now. And we're not. We're just not. We had 4 years of delay under the Trump administration, and now we're being held back by one senator.
So just to be clear, even if we were definitely instituting Biden's clean energy program right now, that wouldn't be enough to live up to our pledge.
So it might. So it would make us live up to our pledge because our pledge was 26 to 28% 2005 levels. But the pledge is not enough to get us below 1.5 degrees C. And the goal with the Biden administration would get us to about 45% reduction, which is pretty close. We need 50% with the expectation that states would fill in the gap.
I get it. Let's talk more about the COP26. Can you give us a preview of this? What are people hoping comes out of it? Why is it happening? A thumbnail sketch, please.
Sure. It happens every year. So this is the 26th one. It's supposed to be the 27th, but it got delayed because of COVID. So they didn't do it last year. And it's basically an annual climate change conference where everybody across the world that are parties to the UN meet to discuss climate change action, because we recognize that climate change is a global problem and no single individual nation can tackle it. The idea in this particular one is both that ramp up that I was telling you about. So the idea that we would come with newer commitments that would get us closer to where we need to be, every country. And the other idea is around financing loss and damages. And early rumblings, both from Boris Johnson, who the conference is in Glasgow this year, so he's Prime Minister of the UK, but he's also essentially the host, and from John Kerry in the United States, suggests that like we shouldn't get our expectations too high.
Tell me about the loss and damages money. That is for what? Who's loss, who's damage?
Yeah, it's essentially saying that there are a lot of countries that did very little to contribute to this problem, but they're suffering disproportionately from the effects. And so loss and damages is basically a way of helping them both deal with the ways in which they have to adapt because of a warming world and deal with the harm that has come to them. And the idea is that the countries that have contributed the most, so like G20 countries, to climate change would help finance lower income and lower emitting countries' adaptation to climate change.
So you have small islands like, these small islands in the Pacific that may virtually be underwater, who have really not contributed a whole lot to climate change, and yet they're suffering the most. And so that's sort of payments to those islands.
Yes, and not just those islands. You know, we keep talking about immigration at the southern border. Well, a lot of that migration, especially from Central America, is being driven by climate change.
Uh-huh. And the conference is starting on Halloween. I find that to be a little scary about climate change.
Well, just remember that most of the world doesn't actually celebrate Halloween. It's a very U.S. holiday, so it is funny to us, but it isn't funny to most people.
Yeah, I get it. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, released their winter outlook yesterday, and it sounds, in a word, chilly.
Yeah, for a lot of the country, it's going to be cooler and drier than usual. It's another La Nina year, so there are going to be more dry days across the southern third of the United States, which, you know, from a weather perspective, where it really matters is the West, because they're in such a persistent drought, and it doesn't seem like that's going to be alleviating.
Ah, so more drought for the
more
West.
More drought.
And California just had their driest year since, what, 1924?
Correct. Yeah, so it's not looking good. You know, it's a really water-stressed state in normal times, and right now it's incredibly water-stressed, and what the winter outlook is saying is that that's not going to let up anytime soon.
And so we should be seeing this effect starting immediately, if that forecast is made for now, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's. I think La Nina technically arrived 4 days ago, so yes, we are already sort of in it.
And remind us what La Nina is?
It's a climate pattern, so there are two. There's El Nino and La Nina, and it's a cyclical climate pattern that has to do with weird things happening in the Pacific. But what mostly matters is that La Nina generally, at least in the U.S., delivers more dry days across the southern parts of the United States, and El Nino tends to be hotter and wetter.
Yeah, and lastly, this isn't just about physical dangers from fires, droughts, floods, and so on. As the Lancet Medical Journal, one of the premier medical journals in the world, makes a point of reporting on every year, climate is also about health, right? What are their concerns?
I mean, it's all over the map. It's mental health. It's tick-borne diseases. It's more pandemics. Like, we're living through it. It's heat deaths. It's pretty much everything. It's to remind people that it isn't just what's happening in the atmosphere. It isn't just what's happening to our homes. It has a direct impact on our physical health and well-being.
Kendra Pierre-Lewis, a senior reporter for the Gimlet Spotify Climate Change podcast, How to Save a Planet.
Thank you so much for having me.